May it please the court, Nathaniel Deakins, registration number 38752 on behalf of Mr. Daniel Stewart. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I would like to focus my argument today on argument number 4, as set forth in the opening brief. I know that there is, I filed a reply brief with respect to argument number 2, and I set forth our argument for the invited error that the Attorney General set forth in its answer brief. So I just asked the court to review the opening brief and the reply brief with respect to the invited error issue. But I would like to focus on argument number 4 today, of course, subject to your questions or concerns. The thrust of our argument is that the prosecution has not proven beyond a reasonable doubt, that is, presented sufficient evidence below, that Mr. Stewart is liable as a complicitor in Mr. Arden Reyes's, we'll call him the principal for today, in the principal's multiple menacings committed inside the Red Lobster restaurant. As this court is well aware, the principal in this case, Mr. Arden Reyes, went into the Red Lobster and brandished a pistol and pointed at several employees, as just sort of waved the gun around and demanded money, was given the money, and escaped from Red Lobster. Jumped into a car which Mr. Stewart was driving, and the car drove off. So for purposes of this argument, we shall assume that the prosecution has presented sufficient evidence that Mr. Stewart acted as a complicitor in the aggravated robbery, as a getaway driver. This argument focuses solely on the menacing convictions. So
all 4 menacing convictions or just 3?
3. 3 of the menacing convictions, not the named victim of the aggravated robbery. I believe I'm not supposed to mention victims by name, so I would just, for ease of reference, just refer to them as 1, 2, 3, and 4. again, as this court is well aware, complicity is a theory of liability that's distinct from strict liability. Recklessness is not enough. The fact that the principal committed reasonably foreseeable crimes is not enough in Colorado. There are, to be sure, there are differences among jurisdictions.
How do you square that principle with, and the Supreme Court has seemed to recognize that principle in a case where it also recognizes that you can be a complicitor in negligent or reckless conduct. How do those two things square up?
Well, I think the cases that Wheeler, Grissom, the cases that speak of negligent or reckless conduct, that the court, appellate courts will not reverse a conviction for a complicitor in those types of conduct because the complicitor acts with, intentionally engages in reckless conduct. So, in other words, the complicitor must have at least the same culpable mental state as the principal. I think that's set forth in Bogdanoff and Grissom, which reaffirms Bogdanoff, that in order to convict a someone under the theory of complicity, there's a dual mental state. With the first requirement, of course, being that they have the same culpable mental state as for the underlying offense which the principal commits, and also that they intend to promote or facilitate the commission of the offense. Now, I think it's very difficult, or maybe not for this court, but for me, and it's tempting to want to hold Mr. Stewart liable for everything which the principal does. But I think, as is illustrated by the evidence, the closing arguments below, the prosecution did not establish that Mr. Stewart intended to bring about these multiple menacings, that he wanted to bring about the scare of multiple people. Now, again, it's tempting.
It was a crowded restaurant, and I think you said he was that the principal was brandishing a gun. If Mr. Stewart is liable as a complicitor, how can he not be liable for those things that happened? He knew perfectly well the man was going in to a restaurant with a gun, and it was a crowded restaurant where there were lots of people. Was there some sort of understanding you would only point the gun at one person and nobody else?
Well, it's unclear, Your Honor. And again, I think the prosecution has the burden of proving the culpable mental state for Mr. Stewart as to each of the crimes charged in the information. And again, there's this distinction between a complicitor must intend that the principal commit the crime for which he's charged. I think that's the thrust of the argument. That just because, and I may be repeating myself, but since the principal goes in and maybe perhaps it was reckless of Mr. Stewart to agree to commit an aggravated robbery that at the risk that multiple people would be threatened with a weapon. But at the same time, recklessness under this theory of liability is not enough. There must be an intent. I think the cases make clear, and I think the treatises prefer that rule, and treatises like Wayne LaFave, they square this, what Colorado has done, what the legislature has done here, is require more of a direct connection. So if you compare it to other legislatures in Minnesota, I think I put in my brief, it's written into the statute that a complicitor is liable for all reasonably foreseeable crimes that the principal commits in the course of, let's say, the most serious offense. So in this case, aggravated robbery. The complicitor is liable if the principal waves his gun around. But just to get back to the Mr. Stewart's precise claim, which is that the prosecution did not present sufficient evidence below, I think it's important to focus on the elements of the crime combined with the theory of liability which they proceeded under, which is complicity. And I think that the prosecution did not present sufficient evidence to establish that Mr. Stewart intended Mr. Arden Reyes to wave his gun around. He did, unfortunately. But the fact that Mr. Stewart should have been aware of that or was negligent in this act is not enough under
complicity. Couldn't the jury infer the fact that he intended that when he knew that the principal was going into a crowded restaurant?
I think that the inference is extremely slight, and I think there's a lot of hoops to jump through, and therefore is not enough.
But why is it any less so than whether the evidence supported the conviction for complicity to commit the robbery? I mean, if the evidence showed and the jury could reasonably believe that he knew that his colleague had a gun, he knew he was going in there to rob the store, and the store was open, isn't it a reasonable inference that there would be more than one person in there, and that if he had his gun and he was trying to commit robbery, he was going to be a complicitor to menacing as well? I mean, I don't see why it's that much of a stretch if you're conceding that the evidence was sufficient that he was a complicitor for purposes of the aggravated robbery charge.
Your Honor, I have a couple of responses to that, and the first is, again, I think there's the risk that Mr. Stewart should have been aware, but that's not enough. And then the second response is that I think that Bogdanoff and cases that reaffirm Bogdanoff, there's an intent requirement that he has to intend for there to be these menacings. Now, I understand that there is evidence, the prosecution presented evidence that the car pulled up outside of the Red Lobster. But I think that in order to jump from there to Mr. Stewart intending that Mr. Reyes threatened multiple people with the gun, you have to go through the aggravated robbery conviction. And I think that complicity to aggravated robbery covers the elements of that crime, covers Mr. Stewart's, the extent to which the prosecution has proven Mr. Stewart's actions.
What's the AG's brief cites the Model Penal Code, the Model Penal Code commentaries, and as I understand the Model Penal Code commentaries, they actually endorse your position that says, no, don't hold somebody liable for reasonable and foreseeable crimes without the underlying intent. But they also seem to say at another part in these commentaries, but that's different from a crime that lies smack dab within the purpose of whether it's the enterprise or the the people acting together. Why wouldn't these crimes, menacing, be subsumed in, be within not just foreseeable consequences, but why wouldn't it be within the already contemplated purpose of the crime?
Your Honor,
did I make any sense with that question?
Yes, I think so.
Oh, thank you.
Well, my first response is that the common enterprise theory of liability or doctrine, if you will, is limited to recklessness and negligence, I think, by our Supreme Court. But I'd also just point out, and I didn't put this in my reply brief, but I think in the case of Grissom versus People, our Colorado Supreme Court noted that the Colorado General Assembly has chosen to not ignore the Model Penal Code, but has, if I can just, maybe I'll just quote, just reference.
We didn't cite Grissom as a supplemental authority, did we, counsel? Did you cite
No.
Grissom as a supplemental authority or in your briefs?
I don't believe so.
Okay. In the future, I would suggest that you any case you want to discuss an oral argument, that you would cite it as supplemental authority. I'm hoping and counting on that the Attorney General already knows about this case anyway.
I think the case is important mostly for the principles that it reaffirms from Bogdanov, but
go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. The legislature acted deliberately and rejected the rationale of the Model Penal Code when defining complicity. So I think that there's just evidence in the case law that the Supreme Court has recognized that the Colorado General Assembly, unlike states like Minnesota, for example, have chosen to limit complicity theory to crimes which the state can show that the complicitor intended to bring about.
That just takes us though back to what I understand the central issue is whether, okay, even if you assume that that's the case, is the evidence here sufficient to show the kind of intent that you're saying that you need for this crime?
And I think that was your question that I didn't answer originally, and I apologize, but
regardless of what the Model Penal Code may say.
Right. Well, the evidence shows that Mr. Stewart, and I'm sure the Attorney General will maybe bring up some other facts, but that Mr. Stewart screeched up to a stop sign as Mr. Arden-Reyes was approaching. And they introduced Mr. Stewart's inconsistent statements after the crime. We concede that that's sufficient to get to the jury on the crime of aggravated robbery. But in order to now jump to whether Mr. Stewart intended for Mr. Arden-Reyes to point the pistol at, you know, multiple other people, I think that that inference is too strained. I think you have to go through, in order to reach that conclusion, it's just these menacings are incidental to the aggravated robbery. And while that's tough to stomach, I think, in some respects, the case law and the Colorado Supreme Court have indicated that that's not enough. I like, by way of analogy, I'm not sure if this will be helpful, but in a SPOTO analysis, you know, another arena of criminal law, between the second and third steps, whether something is relevant to the case and whether it has a purpose that's relevant other than the prohibited purpose, I think it's difficult to distinguish that. And oftentimes, in order to get past step three, you have to go through step two, which is the impermissible purpose. And in this case, in order to infer that Mr. Stewart intended that Mr. Arden-Reyes threaten these multiple people, you have to go through the aggravated robbery. All they've shown is that he intended to commit aggravated robbery. I'm not sure if that's helpful, but. And the cases in the treatises say that's not enough because recklessness is not enough, reasonably foreseeable is not enough. They have to show that he intended. The prosecution didn't present the testimony of Mr. Arden-Reyes. The prosecution they certainly called multiple witnesses to the scene, but they had nothing, no recording of what happened inside the car, no statement from Mr. Stewart that, you know, go in there and scare those people. Again, there is an inference. I think it's too strained in order to sustain a conviction for these multiple menacings.
Thank you, Mr. Deacon.
We ask that you reverse the judgments of conviction.
Thank you, and your time is up.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Paul Kaler, 19210. I'm a first assistant attorney general in the appellate division. This issue is a sufficiency claim. It's a circumstantial evidence case. As the court knows, the question is whether a reasonable finder of fact could have found the essential elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And we also know from many circumstantial evidence cases that a person's acts can be determined, or a person's mental state can be determined from their acts. And what we're focusing on here is that language from Bogdanoff that talks about complicitor liability cannot be based on probabilities or reasonably foreseeable consequences. Takes that from Judge Hand's opinion in Paoni, which was explained in somewhat detail by the drafters of the model penal code and their commentaries. The question is, these two limitations on probabilities or against reasonably foreseeable consequences has to do with crimes attenuated from the main crime at issue.
Is that made clear in the model penal code commentaries?
I think it is, Your Honor. If you look at it, when you talk about what the examples they give anyway, most of them are rather old-fashioned, clearing land so that a farm boy clearing land that he knows will be used by a moonshiner, a telephone company renting or giving phone service to someone they suspect will be running a bookmaking operation. A more up-to-date one would be, could a large-scale drug importer be found guilty as a complicitor of street-level sales about which the large-scale drug dealer could not know about it. Those are all crimes attenuated from the main one here. The question that's involved in this kind of case is, were these particular acts, could a reasonable fact finder have found that they fell within the scope, within the means, within the end of the crime at issue? And our argument is that when a person acts as a getaway driver in an armed robbery, they can be held guilty as complicitors, if we have enough evidence that they were part of the robbery team, for any sort of crime coming out of the scope of that crime. Could be kidnapping of a hostage, could be assaults, could be murders if we didn't have the felony murder rule, I think I said assaults, and in this particular case, could be menacing, because the goal is to take money from a business by force and by threats of force. And anything that falls within the scope of that goal of the two, a reasonable finder of fact could find that the defendants discussed this, or it could be they at least contemplated this when they came to their agreement.
And why isn't the conviction of the one menacing, which counsel admitted would be upheld on this basis, why isn't that enough? Why four convictions for menacing?
Because there were
all three other convictions are within the scope and means?
Yes, Your Honor, because when a person, it's reasonable for a fact finder to determine that when people are setting up an armed robbery, and you're going to use a gun in a restaurant with multiple employees at a crowded time of business day, lots of people could be menaced by pulling out the gun and threatening, give me your money or you're going to die. If the defendant had walked into the one of the dining rooms there and fired over the shots at everybody's head saying, this is a robbery, everybody keep out of my way, he could have been convicted of possibly 100 different menacing counts. Here it was limited to the manager who was forced to back to the bar to pull the till out and the three hostesses that were at the front of the restaurant with her. So I think a reasonable fact finder could find that all these crimes fell within the scope of their plan, and they do not constitute the probabilities or reasonable foreseeable circumstances that Paoni and Bogdanoff and the model penal code are concerned with.
Are probable and foreseeable circumstances and within the scope really essentially part of the same test, except within the scope is more closely related?
I think they're just trying to, that language is used to cover the idea of crimes that are attenuated or not, that do not fall within the scope of the particular crime itself.
And what's the test that we would use to distinguish those two different kinds of crimes that you're talking about? what are the factors that we would look at to have us conclude on the one hand that something is attenuated and on the other hand not?
Well, my bias, Your Honor, is always that it has to be come down to could a reasonable finder of fact, could a reasonable juror find that, and only in really strange and weird and outlandish circumstances. Like, I realize that this court has followed what I call the fingerprint evidence rule, and the Supreme Court does that, this sort of special gloss on the top of sufficiency examinations. But here, the question is, was menacings, or if there had been a kidnapping, or had been a pistol whipping, or other crimes that the trigger man committed during the course of this crime, do those all fall within the scope of the crime? And I think this court, applying a very broad standard of review, would have to say, yes, menacing of people during the course of an armed robbery falls within this big scope. And if any sort of fine-tuned discussions or determinations have to be made by the juries or the trial court acting as fact finder itself.
Would you be surprised to know that other jurisdictions consider assaults committed during a robbery as within the probable and foreseeable consequences rule?
Could very well happen, Your Honor. I think my reading of our complicity statute, it appears pretty closely based on the model penal code statute, or the model penal code's recommended language, maybe even broader by the use of the language used in our complicity statute. But I think it's not one of those offenses.
Are you familiar with the Grissom case?
I'm not off the top of my head, Your Honor.
Hold on one second. One question that I'm leading up to is, Grissom seems to suggest that the model penal code commentaries may not be that helpful. And I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge.
Yeah, Mr. Keller, why don't we do this, since you're not in a position to respond to the Grissom case today. The court will give you till end of the business day next Monday. If you want to send in no more than a 3-page letter addressed to each of the judges on this panel, just giving us your views on the Grissom case and its potential applicability here. If you choose not to file something, that's fine too, but let us know. But certainly by the end of the day, next Monday.
Okay, I'll be sure to do that. But I think our argument has to do with, I think what Model Penal Code was talking about, and I think what the Supreme Court was talking about, Bogdanoff, was referring back to what Judge Hand was writing about in Paone, are these attenuated crimes? And whether there are problems with the model penal code as far as other parts of the complicity statute, I think what the Supreme Court was talking about in Bogdanoff had to do with these foreseeable, reasonably foreseeable consequences, and I think the reasonably foreseeable consequences have to do with crimes down the line, further passings of counterfeit money and things like that. I'll file that within the next couple of days. If the court has any questions concerning any other claims, I'd like to try and address those.
I have a question on the instructional error. Do you agree with defense counsel's argument that defendant could have been convicted of a complicitor in the aggravated robbery and menacing even if he had never fathomed the robber's actions until the robber came running down the sidewalk toward the car? Do you agree that under the supplemental instruction, the jury could have convicted him as a complicitor even if the defendant never knew of what the robber was up to until the robber came running back to the car?
Probably not. Well, no, I think he would just be guilty of accessory to the aggravated robbery then.
Under the supplemental instruction, not under the law, but under the supplemental instruction, the wording in the supplemental instruction, could the jury have found him guilty as a complicitor, if he only realized what the fellow was up to as he came running back down the sidewalk?
I don't think the jury could have convicted him on that ground, Your Honor.
And why?
Because the trial court explicitly directed the jury to look at the jury instructions of complicity and accessory and clearly laid that out.
Did the use of accessory before, during, and after the fact tend to confuse any application of those other instructions?
No, I think it's only confusing to people, Your Honor, who used to think about those concepts a long time ago. It's I think it just directed the jury that complicity has to do with either before or helping during the crime, and accessory has to do with helping a person escape from that. It was just, it was something that could be confusing to lawyers, but not confusing, I don't think, to non-lawyers that are on the jury panel.
Yeah. With respect to the merger argument, I'm wondering, the aggravated robbery here required use of a deadly weapon, and the under the charge, and the menacing requires serious bodily injury. Under aggravated robbery, even though it only refers to bodily injury, since there's a deadly weapon being used, isn't it necessarily the case that the victim is going to be under fear of serious bodily injury?
Well, I think that goes into the old prohibited argument where you base a greater, lesser included offense determination on the facts of the particular case.
No, I'm actually just talking about the statute, the statutory.
Yeah, I think that's reading too much in it. I think it's reading too much in the statute, Your Honor. I think there's a couple of differences between robbery and the menacing. Robbery requires a reasonable fear of death or bodily injury, and menacing requires imminent serious bodily injury. I think there's a difference there. A trial court could merge those two offenses if they were based on the same evidence, as far, at least as far as consecutive, concurrent sentencing type thing. But as far as a strict elements test, and which is what we were based on, I think the difference between reasonable fear of death or bodily injury and imminent fear of imminent serious bodily injury, that's enough of a difference between the two so that it's not the exact same offense. I think that's what this court held in Cisneros a long time ago. And also, too, I didn't really explain it all in my brief all that well, but when we were talking about the sentencing issue in my brief, these were two separate fonts of evidence for the menacing conviction concerning the manager and the aggravated robbery of her. The menacing occurred at the front of the restaurant when Ardon Reyes pulled out the gun and made his original threats. The robbery happened when he forced her to back to the till in the bar and took the money there. This is entirely two separate fonts of evidence. The court could say these are exact same, these would be subject to merger, but because they are based on separate fonts of evidence, they would not be greater and lesser in this particular case.
So you're saying even if it's a lesser included offense, statutory elements wise, it would still not be merged because these are factually distinct?
Right, they happen in different parts in time. The menacing happened, and then the aggravated robbery happened.
In terms of nanoseconds, they're factually distinct?
That's what can happen. That's the difference between aggravated robbery and accessory to aggravated robbery.
Even between lesser included offense, even assuming they're lesser included offenses.
Right. If they occurred right on top of each other, they still would not be greater and lesser included offense. Our argument is not only do they not match up exactly like is required under the test, but they happen side by side, different temporal times. Any other questions I could try and help the court with? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Mr. Deakins, I think your time is pretty much up, so thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Counsel on the Stewart case are excused. And if counsel on the Woodman case want to set up at counsel table, we'll move ahead on that case.